Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumba. Michelle Manu has been described as the dangerous wahine. Why? She is a kumu, one of the only women teachers in the world of Hawaiian combat martial arts called lua. Michelle says she has always felt the spirit of a warrior. In her classes, she encourages her students to take up intentional movement for healthy living, which she says is an art her Hawaiian ancestors not only practiced, but perfected. Michelle, aloha.
Aloha, Bobby. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful to have you here. Now, you share quite a diverse mix of lineages.
Yeah, so my father is Hawaiian, Filipino, Chinese, English, and then my mom is Norwegian, Danish, and some Scottish, so more of the Viking side. And they married in the early 70s and, yeah, produced quite a few of us. So interesting, background and mixture of ethnicities.
When you say produced quite a few of us, how many are we talking?
Oh, there's five, so it's not too crazy. Not like my father's side with 13, you know.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Where did you grow up?
So we moved around, but primarily Southern California. So it was the time where, brown and white would be considered interracial, as equivalent to black and white. And in the United States, continental-wise, Northern American continent, it was probably the least prejudicial in Southern California. There were still issues, but it seemed like the right place for them to settle down without having to deal with the racial aspect in the U.S.
What were some of your interests as a child growing up?
Oh my goodness. I don't know. I was always kind of made weirdly, I thought. I didn't gravitate to the normal things that girls were forced to do. You know, the girls' activities of, I'm a ballet dropout at 4 years old. And, you know, I didn't care for the bows and the hair and the lacy socks and the things that were in at that time for girls. I really enjoyed playing with the neighborhood boys and my guy friends from school. And I loved surfing and skateboarding and playing American football and climbing trees and roughing it up and that sort of thing. And it was about 9 years old where I was on team for gymnastics and then also started my martial arts training. So quite young.
Did you face any challenges because of your identity and interest growing up?
Yes, all the time. Yeah. Of course, I didn't have many friends, but we moved around a lot. So I was always a new girl, which I think is actually really beneficial for being able to adjust no matter where I am. I don't know. I guess being a girl, one, but two, of mixed heritage, there wasn't much diversity back then. So I think there was one other Hawaiian family in the high school by the time I left. Not much diversity.
With so many different cultures in your heritage, how would you describe yourself or identify to people if they asked you?
Well, I say Hawaiian, Asian, and Scandinavian, and that usually works. I know that my siblings say Eurasian because they are actually not on the West Coast. They're all scattered throughout the rest of the country. So most people don't know what Polynesian is or what Hawaii is. It's more now than ever. But back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, people weren't really sure what that was. So, yeah, they unfortunately just have to give them in terms how they would understand really what their heritage would be.
How did you connect with your Hawaiian community?
It was interesting. My father left at a young age to go ahead and pursue his education on the continent. And that's where he met my mother. And that's why they pretty much settled in Southern California. But he left and really didn't go back. It wasn't really discussed why he was upset with, I don't know, his family or his culture. And so we were forbidden to really learn much about that side. Any side, actually. We just needed to be American. So assimilate. Yeah. So that prohibition, that kapu or forbiddenness of not being able to know more just drew me closer to wanting to know more. So it's been a while now where I've been pursuing more knowledge, seeking out kumu and teachers of different cultural practices. And while then, of course, I trained with my teacher for 24 years when he passed. So, you know, it started when I was young, but really didn't kick off until I wouldn't say that. This is terrible. I'm bouncing around because I actually was touring as a Polynesian performer on stage across the Midwest at 15. I was with a hula halau at 11. So I think I've always just been kind of exposed to it, but really just didn't dive in until probably 10 years ago. And that's when I really started teaching, was 10 to 13 years ago.
Can you share with us a little bit more about your performing as a 15-year-old?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So I go from a secret, you know, my father didn't know, but we were with a hula halau when I was 11. And I was not one of the big girls. And we had a very strict kumu. So I never made it off the floor. It was hula noho. So I was on my knees or sitting the whole time. I was able to use an ipu or uli uli, the river rocks, and several different other implements, but I never got to use my legs. And so I ended up moving to the Chicagoland area. And I literally the same month just turned 15, and I met a Samoan Italian family out there, and they said, "Hey, you're Hawaiian." And I said, "Yeah, what about it?" You know? and they said, "Hey, do you want to dance?" And I was like, "What do you mean dance?" And so I started shortly after, learned the choreography. I was on stage and I was using my legs, and I thought, oh my gosh, I am so grateful to have this experience. And, you know, it wasn't halau culture. It was performing culture. So we were all over the States in that area. And I think my record of all the summers was 11 shows in 1 week. And that's just outrageous. So I did a lot of conditioning. I studied other martial arts, Nautilua, for the conditioning aspect. And I was also at the gym sometimes twice a day just to keep my cardio up, because these are anywhere from 45 minutes to 2 hours at costume changes, running back and forth. So, you know, it's funny too, because I always knew back then I loved my hula, but I didn't really understand the connection with the martial aspect, the lua. And I was always the one that people would make fun of, because I'm like, you guys are going to be tired during the show because you're practicing half-assed. And so what are you guys doing? You should practice as if we're on the stage now. And they're like, whatever, Nazi, you know, hula police. And then I realized after I moved back to Southern California, that, and I started my lua training, that was why, like, it was always in me to show the punctuation in the hula, because it just shows that the martial was always there just waiting to be birthed. It was just concealed in the hula. And so now I freely get to practice both, you know, so, and one into the other. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about that now. Oh, so what was it about lua that interested you?
Well, one, I mean, I would never think that people would see it. It's so secretive. We hear about it, but we don't really know who teaches. We don't know where the schools are. It's not like a brick and mortar where you can just walk up, buy a uniform and join. And it's still like that today. And so when I saw my teacher, I thought, this couldn't be, this can't be, this has got to be a derivative of it. And it is slightly, because it's been modified for modern times. So it has been evolved. It's not the ancient ways, but I kept calling. I wasn't allowed to speak with him. And so I just kept calling back. And even though I was getting hung up on, the last time I said, I don't know what's happening, but we keep getting disconnected. I'll just keep calling back. And so my phone number was finally taken, and he called 20 minutes later. And I don't know, I just knew this was one of those important moments, but I didn't know what. And so he invited me to a class. I explained, I spoke very quickly. I've been an athlete my whole life, been a competition cheerleader. I've been a competition gymnast. I have a hula, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, slow down. Okay, come and watch. We'll see what you think then. And I got to watch a class, and I always really brag on my kumu brothers, my lua brothers that I was brought up with, because they were just a beautiful unit, almost like a military, the way that they moved. And you could tell there was just tremendous respect for their teacher, you know, Olohe. So at the end of class, I was like, my goodness, I just saw like a dozen men just moving in sync and not breathing until he says breathe, and over and over and over and over, hitting the ground hundreds of times, cement with shoes on. And he brings out the paperwork and I sign it, and I came the next morning, and it's history from there. I didn't know when I walked up that evening to watch a class that my whole life would change. So pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit more about your kumu?
Yeah. My Alohe, he's our Alohe, he's not just mine. He left us in July about 5 years ago. Very, very beautiful man, but very tough, very old school. Was taught by his mother and father, who were taught by their parents. And this is a blood lineage that I was learning. So he took it very seriously. And during the time of the 70s, 80s, and 90s in the US, you know, you had Bruce Lee, you have Ed Parker, you have all of these gentlemen that are masters and, you know, gaining a lot of notoriety and a lot of students. And so Alohe set out to prove that the Lua was just as viable and deadly, or if not more deadly, than other arts. So his children, he had five children, and they grew up in Lua, and they are so tough. And they were, as well as other students, forced to compete. And in these competitions, the goal was, of course, to beat their opponent, but most times to get disqualified. And that was to show the brutality of Lua in a sports environment. And it worked. Alohe is remarkable. This man served in the Air Force. He met his wife in Germany. She came back with him, and they settled in Colorado for a short period and ultimately settled in Southern California. So lucky for me. And, you know, he spent his life promoting his family's Lua. And without him, there are many of us, myself included, would not be here where we are today, perpetuating the Hawaiian culture and the Lua the way we are. He left the homeland to bring it here. And he taught not just Kanaka Maoli, but he also taught non-Hawaiians. So there are a lot now that are really quite masterful in our Lua that are not of Hawaiian descent. And they do it with respect, most of them. Some of the Kanaka will say, she wasn't raised here. And that's true. My father was raised back home. But guess what? If I wasn't here and I didn't find Alohe Solomon Kaʻiwalu, I would have never been exposed to the Lua, nor would I have ever been given the opportunity to learn. So the irony of learning away from the Aina just to bring it back to the Aina really floors me still, you know, because I think most of us that are diaspora and off the Aina, we miss home. We miss being connected daily. We're still connected, but it's different. But, you know, we're always seeking the approval of our families and people back home. And sometimes we don't receive that. So.
You mentioned that Lua was secretive and it is hard to find this community. Why was that?
Well, in about 201 years ago, our queen Kaʻahumanu banned the Lua from public display. Everyone likes to blame the missionaries, and it was because of the missionaries indirectly. Our queen saw how they gasped and were terrified when they saw the Lua being performed at a ceremony. And so she stood and banned it. And so it was verbally into Hawaiian kingdom law, but never written. And then about 3 to 4 years later, it was written into kingdom law by Queen Kaʻahumanu that the hula would be banned as well. But in that time, and even beyond that, the hula went into hiding, and it was concealed within the hula since hula was still allowed. And in the metro areas where there were people watching for, you know, violations of kingdom law, they would practice at night indoors, and they would mostly hula. So do martial forms, martial hula, if you will, but it looks like hula. So you didn't really know the difference. But on the outskirts of town, people still practice, but very discreetly. So it never really died. That is why I think it's secret. And we had one king that, Kuhio, that tried to revive it. He did revive hula, and it was unsuccessful. However, there was a resurgence in Lua in the 70s, 60s, it started, but 70s. And there were a lot of the men that came forward that knew Lua of one lineage back home, and they've been promoting and acting as historians and teaching those. But for the most part, you have to be chosen, right? You can still say, I would love to learn, but you're not necessarily accepted. So there are a lot of Kanaka Maoli that have not seen Lua, have not been exposed to it at all or any of the facts. So they regurgitate what they hear popular in Hawaiian culture because it's modern, not Maoli, not ancient. So they're just regurgitating what they've heard for over 200 years. And unfortunately, that it's still kept secret from those that wish to learn. So my goal is to make that available to our people that haven't had a lot of access. So Wahine and Keiki, the children, the kupuna, the elders, and elderly, as well as the mahu, the same sex. So I think over the last 2 years, our culture has been written from a very masculine point of view, sometimes not from our own people's hand. And everything is very patriarchal and very masculine. So a lot of the Kanaka believe that women were never part of Lua and that there were no women warrior foremothers. And I'm here to tell you that that is not true. And I hope for one day with my involvement that we can destigmatize the thought of, the sight of, or hearing of history of our Koa Wahine leaders, that it's just it's a no-brainer. And there isn't this emotional response like, there was never any women. That's when my life is complete, when it's just like, oh, it's a Hawaiian warrior. And that's what I would love to see. I'd love to see our Wahine train up and our little Keiki Koa too. The boys need it too, right? So that's why I go home when I'm invited to teach. And yeah, it's wonderful to see. And you see them step more into who they are. And this is why I'm made this way. This is what was missing. And that energy that surges through our body, it changes things. All this stuff, it doesn't do anything. Oh, the waha, it doesn't do anything. It's the actual movement in it. It's medicine, just like hula. You know, I always say, if you're upset, go do light hula, do light, move, connect everything, move in hina, flow. You know, if you're happy, a little bit more upbeat, faster hula, you know, but if you're angry or confused or just can't figure things, then hard hula, like kahiko, get low, go until you can't go anymore, go sprinting, do all these things that burn you out, heavy body weight exercises. Guess what? 5 to 7 minutes later, you feel better. So you don't need a pill. You don't need to go drinking. You know, it's really for us Polynesians, I believe that our body is the conduit of this mana. And the more we move in it, the more it heals us and sorts things out ways that we don't even know. Thank you.
Thank you. What does it mean to have a warrior spirit?
Oh my gosh. Well, that's different things. You know, we think of warrior today and it's such a misused word, you know, tax warrior, weekend warrior, yoga warrior, all these warriors. So it's just such a cliche, right? Men are proud to be warriors. They say, I am a warrior. These are male warriors. But when women, the general woman, the everyday woman doesn't like that word because they don't want to go to war. They don't want to hurt anyone. Why? Because we're protectors. And that is really, we protect. We've always protected. It's when, even look at the animal kingdom, you know, when someone or something is threatened, these female animals will respond. And after that one point, then they're willing to go to war. Then they're warriors. But we're always protectors. This is who we are. And so to me, being a woman warrior is intellect, the masculine, the ku, with the intuitive, the intuition, which is the hina and the feminine. You can't have one without the other. You know, the Maori, they say, you know, there's the he, the inhale, and the ha, the exhale. And this is true. And unfortunately, in Hawaiian, we only talk about ha, the breath of life, but you can't just exhale. So you need both. And in physics, this shows too. So I talk about these physical movements. The wahine is the wind up to a pitch in baseball, American baseball, or the leg coming back for a soccer kick. The kick, the actual kick, the kinetic energy is the ku. But you need the potential strategy of the lines of that. Same with a punch. You get here, here's the female. Here, female, female, female. Masculine, male. So you see, they work in So a woman warrior to me is using her intellect. She's thinking about things and she's also feeling about things. And those two together make a really wise, formidable protector who then will resolve, you know what? Don't do it. I warned you. Don't do it. That's it. It's war. And they protect. And so that leads into every other area of our life, whether it's academics, our personal relationships, our professional relationships. We get to use this warrior wisdom in everything we do. Because what is preparedness? warriors are prepared. They don't just exit the hale of the house and do martial arts techniques all day. They're not robots. They study in so many things. As warriors in ancient times, we've lost that today. Now we just look for belts. We look for rank. We look for martial choreography. It is truly martial dance today, unless you really understand the biomechanics of your body and you feel that mana surging through you. You got to know the body. So whether I stick a pahi, a knife in your hand, or I stick a leo mano in your hand, you know, the shark tooth club, you can still move and you're not going to cut yourself because you understand your body and you understand how to generate your mana and release it and where you need to be. And so like in this lineage of Lua that I teach, it's the ohana, the family. So from the waist down is the man, from the waist up is the woman, including the po'o, the head. And then the arms are the keiki. And then from the wrists to the fingertips are the mo'opuna, the grandchildren. Everyone has a job. And so we got to make sure we're not off balance. We got to make sure we don't keep the kids out there after we do something. They'll get abducted, right? The grandchildren have to stay together, right? Okay, and then we have all the animals too on top of that. So it really is about feeling that energy throughout your entire body and knowing how to control it. Where are you throwing it? How much? 20%, 40%, 60%. Are you drawing it back? Like, are, you know, what are you doing? So it's very exciting to talk about this, as you can see, because this is just so integral to who we are.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber, and I'm speaking with Kumu Michelle Manu. Did you always want to be a Kumu?
No, never. it was a surprise. And I just wanted to be the best practitioner that I could because my life depended on it. I wasn't exactly welcomed when I first started training. I had about an 8-year hazing period within the group that shifted in year 8 sometime. And so I had to survive every class. And all of us, not just me because I was the only female, but all of us didn't know if we would be walking out of there after class or if we would be in an ambulance. So we have very hard classes, a lot of stingers, a lot of injuries, and I never expected to be a teacher ever. I just expected to be the best practitioner so I could be the most effective protector and warrior there is. And when he surprised some of us with the Kumu title and the Kuleana responsibility that comes with it, you don't argue with him, you take it. So I have my paperwork, and then I guess I was just asked to teach with some women in Northern California. And I asked for several years. He finally said yes. And that began truly how I started teaching, period.
Mm. What do you mean by an 8-year hazing period? Ooh, what did this hazing look like?
I probably shouldn't have said that, but it they didn't. They know it's true. It's probably shouldn't be public knowledge, but this is just it's not a piece of how pia cake, right? This is, I think that they believe that I was a distraction. I think they believe that they didn't want a woman in class. I think they believe that my teacher really didn't want me there and wanted them to help me quit. But when I didn't, I was told that when I first came in, I was a complete distraction. I had, my mana was unhinged. I was a wild one. I really was. I wasn't exactly the most healthiest, and training healed me. That's why I'm saying this mana that flows through our body. But a lot of injuries. I broke the right side of my rib cage. I've had several concussions. I've broke every finger that I have in class. I think I blacked out once, but I can't really remember. And I'm sure there's more. I mean, I fractured the inside of my hip. I guess I just forget. After a while, you just keep showing up and you work through it. You know, as the first woman in, I think, 25 years that had shown up for training, had been accepted. And I think that my teacher, in fact, in the beginning did want me to quit. I think he had hopes for me, but I think he tried to make me quit. But you know what? In the end, I am bulletproof. I have been through so much. I mean, before my training and during and now after, that there really isn't anything that's going to shake me in a physical manner. I bite with my teeth. Like, forget technique. Like, if it comes down to it, you, until my last breath, that's it. That's my motto. And it's not over until it's over.
So. I love this idea that you are bulletproof. Can you tell me more about your ideas behind intentional movement?
Yes. I mean, we have to understand that we're not just checking out, going to the gym, going for a run, just that the mind and the body and the spirit are separate. They are not. In fact, I believe it's body first. Once the body feels good, is hydrated, it has nutrients, is rested, is considered like a family member that cannot care for itself. Instead of us thinking we can tell it what to do, it gives us messages. It's such a blessing. And it's a package in which we go through the world and do our work. So I really believe setting your spiritual intention of why you're moving before you start moving, then kind of brings you all together into this harmony or lokahi. So you get the most out of the movement. And if you tell the body, I want you to get rid of toxins, I want you to shed this, I have some pain here, let's work through that, then it knows where to put its focus. It's an intelligent being. And that's what I mean by intelligent movement.
Are there any lessons that your kumu taught you, which you now bring into your own teaching with students?
Oh my goodness. We're different only because I am a wahine. You know, there's only one Elohe. He's remarkable and very strict, you know, and tough and fast. I hope to be all those things, but with a velvet glove on, I guess, because I'm more about, I don't want to do it out of fear or intimidation. I want to do it out of nurturing. And saying, look, I meet you where you are. I show up because you show up, but you got to show up and you got to give me your best. And I'm not really sure. It's Elohe, but it's in a different delivery, preparedness. And there is no practice. And you practice where it's safe as much as you can with who it's safe to practice with, because one day practice might be over. And I learned that over and over and over with my teacher.
Do you notice the change in your students from when they first come in to, say, a year down the track or a couple of years down the track?
Oh, my gosh, Bobby, it's remarkable. I have this thing, you know about something, you know something, and then you become it, right? And to see them learn about it, know a little bit about it, they're like, oh, wow, oh, my gosh, really? Whoa. Then they start to know more. Then it sparks this investigation. They start researching on their own, and they have writing assignments, too, in my PA. And eventually they become it, and they move effortlessly in certain techniques and certain maneuvers that they put together as techniques. Then, certain weaponry, I start with the short bow, the staff, and then they go into the double sticks, and then they go into the paddle, the Ihe spear, and also the longbow. There's also a strangulation cord, all of the sharp tooth weaponry. We also have the ma'a, the slingshot. That's later after, black proficiency. So to see them move, no matter what I put in their hands or challenges I give them, even though they're probably swearing at me because I could feel it sometimes. F you, Kumu. And I'll call them on it too. Like, I hear some swearing out there, and then some of them will start laughing, but they stick with it and they make me so proud. And I have some senior students now that the difference from last year, the year before, and 3 years ago is just they're different people. And not just that in their movements, but also the pohihihi, the metaphysical studies of who am I? Why do I do this? How do I handle anger? And how do I handle my money? The metaphysics of forgiveness. And why do we need forgive, or do we not? Do we need that energy? Do I need my anger? Like, some of this is not like from a very US, point of view, the Christian point of view of releasing everything. But sometimes you need that to bring you into the coup and the action. So it's really interesting to see them change and read their writings every time that they state their intention that they're going to evaluate for the next warrior level, and to see where they were and how they develop in each level is just remarkable to me.
Would you say Lua has transformed your life?
Yes, without a doubt. I don't know actually who I would be without my Lua on every level.
Michelle Manu, what an incredible woman. And you've excited me with your excitement, your enthusiasm, your strength. Thank you so much for joining me and for giving us just a small insight into the work as a kumu of Lua. Thank you very much.
Mahalo.
That was Michelle Manu, kumu of the art of Lua. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. And to catch more great stories about incredible people from the Pacific, just search for ABC Pacific. If you or someone you know has an interesting story to share, you can email us at abcpacificradio@abc.net.au.
This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people, and I'm hosting this story on the lands of the Kaurna people.